Hi, everyone. It's Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Board-certified gynecologist, sexual medicine, and menopause expert in downtown Chicago. Today, I'm super excited for this podcast. It's been in the making for a while. We're going to talk about estrogen. Fear around estrogen has shaped women's health narrative for the last 20 plus years. And I'm super excited to have my guest on today, Dr. Avram Blooming. He's a medical oncologist. He's co-author of Estrogen Matters. And basically, he's sort of the OG when it comes to a lot of breast cancer and everything that we know about it. But he is an emeritus and clinical professor of medicine at the University of Southern California, a former senior investigator for the National Cancer Institute, and master of the American College of Physicians, which is actually an honor that's really bestowed upon very few internists. I think less than 500. Is that right, Dr. Blooming?
It's about 500 out of 110,000.
That's amazing. Well, welcome, Dr. Blooming, to my podcast. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I was so happy to have met you last year at ISHWISH when you came and you talked about estrogen and breast cancer. And so I really want to dive right into some of this because you're such a wealth of information. I think that you've really, we always say that estrogen as a hormone has had really bad publicity for the last two decades. And so I feel like you were the new publicist that estrogen needed to kind of defy some of the stuff that's been happening. But before I start, because, you know, my Instagram handle is Gyno Girl, so I love comics and I love superheroes. So I want to hear your backstory. What's your origin story for all the listeners today?
Well, the first important backstory is my wife at age 45 had breast cancer. And we treated it locally, and I gave her chemotherapy to help prevent it coming back. Now, she was 45. She's currently 82. So the story is going along very well.
Yes.
But the chemotherapy that I gave her precipitated a premature menopause in her with many of the symptoms that I'm sure many of the people listening are aware of. She had hot flushes. She had night sweats. She had trouble sleeping. She had trouble falling asleep, trouble staying asleep. She had painful urination. She had palpitations, and I took her to cardiologists, and cardiologists I know and respect had no idea what was causing the palpitations. And because the workup was normal, they told her not to worry about it without explaining what was going on. Now, premature menopause has been a fixture of my practice. 60% of my oncology practice was based on patients with breast cancer, and I induced many such situations. And when women would complain to me, as they did, about the symptoms of menopause, my reaction was, but it's very likely that we've cured your breast cancer, that breast cancer has now better than a 92% cure rate, newly diagnosed breast cancer. And while I was sympathetic, there was really nothing I was offering. My wife didn't complain to me about any of her symptoms. I wasn't aware of many of them. And then she found that she was unable to remember what she had read in a book two pages back. Or when we went to a symphony performance, she didn't recall the symphony that she had known very well. And those symptoms were intolerable. And that's what triggered my saying, wait a minute, is there something that can be done? I ought to listen more carefully to my patients' complaints and see if I can help them. And what I found is that the negative feelings about estrogen and breast cancer, even back then, this is over 40 years ago, were not really based in hard data. And when I reviewed the hard data, I found that estrogen did not appear to cause breast cancer. And women who were diagnosed with breast cancer, even estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, did not have an absolute contraindication to starting hormone replacement therapy. And what I did, rather than just give my wife estrogen, is I started a study. which is now one of the 26 studies in the English literature, of allowing women with a history of breast cancer to go on hormone replacement therapy. And I had to get informed consent so that patients knew the data. And I wrote to the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, and I asked them for consent, for approval. And what they said to me is, well, there are doctors who are already doing this. So if you call it treatment, you don't need our approval. But if you're going to call it a study, you do need our approval. And I said, I'm calling it a study. And they said, well, send us information. And I sent them extensively referenced information about why I wanted to do the study. This was back in 1992.
Wow.
And they wrote me back about 3 weeks later saying, we're putting a hold on your study because we believe that you are putting women at an unacceptable risk of recurrence. And so I said to the man who spoke to me over the phone, a doctor, did anybody read what I sent? And he said to me, and I remember this so clearly because I've heard it many times since, he said, don't shoot me, I'm just the messenger. And so I said, well, please put me in touch with someone who can make a decision. And instead of doing that, I was invited to an FDA hearing in Maryland, which I went to. I was there. Phil Desaia was there, who was the head of OBGYN at the UC San Diego and is one of the leading pioneers in this movement. And so was Wolf Udian, who at the time was the president of what was called the North American Menopause Society.
Right.
And we presented data for half a day to them. And at the end, the chairman of the committee stood up and said, it would be unethical not to do this study. This was 1992. And so I flew home with one of the doctors who was with me. And he said, you know, they didn't give us permission. And I said, it certainly sounded like permission. He said, just wait. And the way we had proposed it is that in my practice, I would do a pilot study, a single-arm pilot study on 300 women to make sure that we weren't pouring kerosene on a fire. And assuming that it passed that test, then UC Irvine would do a study of 5,000 women that would be prospectively double-blinded and randomized. And we thought that was reasonable.
Right.
And about a month after the hearing, I started the study the night I returned from Maryland. But a month later, I got a letter from the FDA saying, even though we approved your study in principle, we don't agree to the single-arm part of the study. We will only approve the prospective 5,000-person double-blind randomized study. And I thought, well, that's irresponsible. Let's make sure we're not doing something harmful first.
Right, right.
And this time I flew back to the FDA, the first trip they paid for, the second trip I paid for, and they reorganized the committee just to hear me, which I thought was very polite.
Right.
And as I was sitting waiting for the meeting to start, these were all physicians. One female doctor, member of the commission, said to me, well, most of your patients are going to die anyway, aren't they? So what's the difference? And I said, aren't you aware of the high cure rate of breast cancer now? And she said, I guess I ought to read about that. Well, yes. And you should have read about it before this meeting. And a man on the committee, also a physician, said, why do you want to do this study? Why don't you do another study? And I said, I am doing other studies, but this is an important study. And they convened the meeting. I spoke all morning. And at the end of the meeting, the doctors said to me, we don't vote to give you approval to do this. We think, in spite of everything you've said to us, you're putting women at an unacceptable risk. Now, this was based not on data. This was based on gut feeling or
gut feeling, right?
Whatever.
Right.
And so I said to the committee, what would happen if I just went back and did the study anyway, which, by the way, I've started a month and a half ago. And the chairman said to me, Dr. Blooming, we can't tell you how to practice medicine. Perfect. I went back home. I continued the study. 5 years later, in 1997, and on the study informed consent form, I had a paragraph that said, even though the FDA approved this study in principle, they did not approve the single arm part of the study that we were doing. And every patient in the study, we collected 300, every patient signed the informed consent form. In 1997, I was asked to present the data we had accumulated over the 5 years. And it turns out I presented it at the plenary session in front of 8,500 oncologists from around the world. And there was a member of the National Cancer Institute at the meeting, and he presented just before me. And what he said is, we at the National Cancer Institute feel it is irresponsible to study administering hormone therapy to women with a history of breast cancer. And I figured, being from Southern California, I will be stoned before I even have a chance to present my data. But I wasn't stoned. In fact, what happened is the doctor giving the NCI point of view was challenged. What data are you basing this on? Why are you saying this? And this was 8,500 doctors from around the world. And his response was, wait for it. Don't shoot me. I'm just the messenger. I detest that statement. And then I got up and presented my data, and here were the leading oncologists from around the world. And every comment after my presentation was positive. Everyone. And so when I returned to California.
Do you mind reviewing what the data showed, just so the listeners know?
The data showed that there was no increased risk of recurrence among women who got the cancer. This wasn't a double-blind study, but when we compared stage by stage, prognostic factor by prognostic factor, there was no increased risk of recurrence. Some women do recur, but there was no increased risk of recurrence. And the women felt so much better. I don't have to tell you. You understand that. And so I got another letter from the FDA, not a phone call, but a letter in 1997 that said, even though we know you don't need our permission to do this study, we are willing to give you retrospective permission to do the study if you like. And I wrote and said, of course I like. And by the way, I will take that warning paragraph off the informed consent form. 1997. So when in 2002, the Women's Health Initiative said we are stopping this study because of the increased risk of breast cancer, it was like a recurring nightmare.
Recurring nightmare, yeah.
That's, totally. That's a long-winded answer, but that's the motivation.
Well, that brings us into the WHI, because I want to talk about that a little bit, as well as, you know, the FDA removal of the boxed warning. But When the WHI came out, I was actually just had finished my first year internship in OBGYN, and we had journal club with a GYN oncologist every week. And so we had only heard the headline. So then she and we reviewed the study, and at the end of it, we're like, oh, it's not that bad. Like, I don't know why they made such a big deal out of it, you know? And she's like, that's why you have to know statistics. That's why you have to know what relative risk is, you know? And then when I rotated with an REI, like, he was, very much like considered fringe because he kept his patients on hormones. He's like, my patients love their hormones. I just don't believe it's as big of a risk as they say. So I came from it from an angle of like, well, it looked like it was the progestin that was the real, you know, culprit here. And so I think that it was very interesting that like the world seemed to stop in 2002 when all these women were flushing hormones down the toilet. And I think, you know, there's so many people that are out talking about, you know, the whether or not it was a conspiracy, you know, by the media and, you know, the government to like, you know, really control women. I mean, in my heart of heart, I believe that there probably, you know, this little bit of patriarchy involved there. But I think that, you know, tell us how you handled it as an oncologist who was then treating women, and I'm assuming some of the women still with hormones at the time, and what you did as a result. Or maybe you want to review, I mean, I think most of my listeners have heard me talk about the WHI a lot, but just a quick review of the summary.
Sure,
of
but
it.
Let me just go back a little. When you said, and so now we believe that it wasn't the estrogen, which, by the way, the WHI found decreases, this is among women who never had breast cancer, but it decreases the risk of breast cancer by 23%. Most importantly, it decreases the risk of breast cancer death by 40%. That's from the WHI, which is the leading voice against hormone replacement pressing tonic.
Right.
And rather than say we were wrong, what was said is, well, it's clearly not the estrogen, never mind that the black label warning, black box warning that was just taken off all estrogen containing products was directed against estrogen.
On
no data, but thank goodness that's been removed. They said, well, it must be the progesterone. And there are articles that go through the literature and say, you know, in this experimental study, in this clinical study, there might be this very small increase. And the words there might be is a very important thing to notice. There is no consistent data that say that it's progesterone. More than that, the progesterone that was used in the Women's Health Initiative was megestrol acetate, MGA. People say, well, that's a progestin. It's a synthesized progesterone. That was lame. Well, no. Two things. First, in the literature, there are reviews of literature that show that when megestrol acetate is used against tamoxifen in a randomized study among women who have measurable breast cancer, it is at least as effective as tamoxifen. It doesn't cause the tumor to grow more. It actually shrinks the tumor more. And the Women's Health Initiative, and I've written quite a few papers on this, that says, well, it's not the estrogen alone. It's only the estrogen progestin arm, that is simply incorrect based on their own data. It is incorrect because even if it were valid, and it's not valid, it would mean one extra case of breast cancer, not that there would be an increased risk of breast cancer death. They never found that, but there'd be one increased case of breast cancer per 1,000 women taking it per year, and even that is not valid because what they did is that they did a study for heart disease, not a study for breast cancer. That was the goal of the study.
That was the end goal.
And if you're going to do a prospective double-blind study, you want to be sure that the risk factors are adjusted so that both arms of the study have the same risk of developing heart disease. And they did that. And what they found is for women who were within 10 years of their last menstrual period, they actually had up to a 50% decreased risk of heart disease. But they then extrapolated to breast cancer. They got this 1 per 1,000 patients taking it per year. And that did not include adjustment for breast cancer risk. When they did adjust for breast cancer risk and retrospectively looked at their data in 2006, and this study was authored by their senior biostatistician, Garnett Anderson from the University of Washington, they said it made no difference. Well, it made a huge difference. The data that they report in that article went from being minimally statistically significant to not statistically significant.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that those nuances and interpretations oftentimes get missed. Can I ask you what some of the, you know, obviously when you went to Ishwish, it was, we all loved your, what you had said. And there are a lot of people that, there's obviously, you know, this is a heated topic, right? People find estrogen and breast cancer very controversial still. And so, you know, there are always some of the people that will disagree and, you know, look at the data differently. Do you think that, because a lot of people contend that because the WHI used conjugated equine estrogens, so it wasn't a pure form of estradiol, that cannot be extrapolated to all estrogens. Like, you can't say that, you know, now we're using more transdermal estradiol. And so a lot of clinicians will contend that we can't actually extrapolate what conjugated equine estrogen does, because some people believe that that is the type of estrogens within that are the ones that actually, like, you know, have some sort of difference. They call them NEST, you know, they're similar to the CIRMs, and they act differently on different tissues. And so there are some doctors that contend that because if the Premarin is kind of more, some of the estrogens within it are, like, you know, a little selective, and they might decrease receptivity at the breast, that you can't actually extrapolate that to estradiol, which is what's used nowadays.
Well, I think the reason that thinking came up was a marketing reason. Mm-hmm. What people said, misinterpreting the Women's Health Initiative, remember we said that the arm, which was only Premarin, that's what they used, which, for those of your listeners, the 102 who don't know, is an acronym for pregnant mare urine, which sounds like a disgusting thing to take. In fact, I had one doctor say to me, you know, it tastes like urine. So I put the pill in my mouth and bit it. I didn't swallow it, but it doesn't taste like urine. It's a pill. Right.
It's a pill, yeah.
But that decreased the risk of breast cancer. Let's remember that. And there are, at least as you point out, 10 different forms of estrogen in Premarin, only one of which is estradiol, which is the estrogen that is the highest concentrated estrogen, as you know, in the circulation of a premenopausal woman. The public was informed that hormone replacement therapy increases the risk of breast cancer after the Women's Health Initiative. First, it's an easy thing to accept, even though it is wrong. And hormone replacement therapy, well, the first thing they replaced was estrogen. As you point out, even though the form of estrogen in the Women's Health Initiative was shown to be significantly beneficial, it was replaced by what was called bioidentical estrogen. Well, that's very nice. Bioidentical, yeah. That's got to be good. Well, as you pointed out, that isn't the estrogen that was administered in the Women's Health Initiative. It might not be as effective in preventing breast cancer. And the truth is, I don't know, but the studies that have been done have not all been done with estrogen, with Premarin. They've been done with a variety of different estrogens. And I've reviewed the literature and published this in 2022. There are 26 studies in the English medical literature studying the administration of hormone replacement therapy to breast cancer survivors. And there are different forms of estrogen used in those studies. And there was only one of the 26 that showed an increased risk of breast cancer development. Not an increased risk of breast cancer death, not an increased risk of metastatic breast cancer recurrence, an increased risk of breast cancer either in the same breast that was treated or in the contralateral breast. And 25 studies showed no increased risk of recurrence. Without getting too technical, I've challenged, and others have challenged, that one study that showed the increased risk in the local breast or the contralateral breast. And it is challengeable and probably should not be taken as gospel. Four of the studies showed a decreased risk of breast cancer development, and that was using different forms of estrogen. So the best data we have suggests that it's estrogen, and different forms don't seem to be different, but I don't have a specific answer to the different forms because I don't think there are.
We haven't done this.
That's exactly right.
Great. Yeah, I'll put it in the link, actually. It was a great article. Tis But a Scratch, right? That was the one you're talking about.
Tis But a Scratch was published last year. The article, this was published in the Cancer Journal. It's called Hormone Replacement Therapy After Breast Cancer, It Is Time, which it doesn't mean it should be given with abandon, but talk to the patient. Give it only if you are an informed physician and the patient is an informed patient, recognizing that we don't have absolute answers, but it's certainly not correct to simply forbid it based on ignorance.
Right. And I think that's kind of the point of what we all try to talk about in menopause, that it should really be precision medicine, right? We should really look at the person in front of you, their risks, what they're suffering with, and how we need to better their quality of life and potentially their health span.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to talk about with you is with regard to when you actually decided to write this book, what obviously you had done the research, you're an oncologist who's been treating breast cancer for decades. And so what actually pushed you into saying, like, it's time for me to let the general public know that they deserve more nuanced care?
The book first was written both for the general public so that it's written in easy to understand language, but it was also written for the medical community so that everything we say in the book is referenced. There are 555 references through the 8 chapters of the book. So when you talk to your doctor about it, the doctor can say, are you going to take the word of a Southern California oncologist over me? The answer is no, but these are pretty convincing data that go back in history and up to the present time. And doctor, what I'd like you to do is read the book and give me your opinion on what this book is saying. The impetus for the book, this wasn't the book I was writing. The book I started to write is a book about what is cancer and what causes cancer. And this was one chapter in the book. And I was writing the book with Dr. Carol Tavares. Dr. Tavares is a PhD social psychologist. She is very smart, but not full of herself. She speaks in such an easy to understand and relate to language, and she has a sense of humor. And as we were working on that first book, she said when we came to this chapter, you know, this should be a book of its own. And it became a book of its own. Still haven't finished that first book, but that's how the book happened.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, speaking of your first book, obviously we don't have the answer to this, but you've been treating cancer and breast cancer specifically for decades at this point. When people ask you, quick reality check, if you're listening to this and thinking, why does no one ever talk to me like this in my doctor's office? That's because most doctors aren't trained to, nor do they have the infrastructure for it. That's why I started the GYN and Sexual Medicine Collective, my new concierge practice where sexual wellness, hormone health, and gynecology actually come together like they're supposed to. No 10-minute visits, no gaslighting, no have a glass of wine, relax. Just evidence-based, shame-free care for women who are done settling for bad sex, brain fog, hot flashes, or feeling invisible. I'm proud to be part of the Ms. Medicine Network, which means your care is rooted in science, not stigma. Find us at www.thegsmcollective.com and book the kind of appointment you wish you had had years ago. Your body called. It wants its power back. Let's go. What causes breast cancer? What do you tell them?
I don't know.
And you're someone that's been treating it for decades and decades. And
well, when I say I don't know, there's not one humility thing. In saying that. I'm a reasonable expert acknowledged in this. Mm-hmm. But there's a certain arrogance too, because when I say I don't know, I know that nobody knows. I'm
nobody
just willing
knows.
To say I don't know, which is
right.
Why I look for data and try to make decisions based on the best of valuable data that I can amass, and I read and study every day.
Mm-hmm. Do you, and so the follow-up question then is, because, you know, people always assume that estrogen causes breast cancer, right? Which we've already obviously discussed. Why is so much of what we do then to treat cancers? I mean, I know, but I just want you to talk to them about, like, why is it, what is the mindset of, like, removing ovaries, you know, reducing your estrogen depletion to a point if it's not even, you know, potentially a cause of it?
That is the core question. And I will try to answer it as best I can with limited mm-hmm. information, recognizing that I don't claim to have the final answer. Cancer cells appear to take advantage of a local environment that allows them to develop. An environment is very important. It's not the cell that we have to destroy. It's the environment that we have to change in order to allow the cell to either die off or mature into a normal cell. And by the way, there are many studies that show that you can take cancer cells of a variety of different types, including breast, and put them in a different environment, and they don't die. The cancer cells mature into normal cells. And it's mm-hmm. the environment we have to target. If the environment is conducive to the development of breast cancer, then what we try to do is change the environment. If the environment is an environment that is rich in estrogen, then the simplest thing to do is to change the environment by removing estrogen. Mm-hmm. Tamoxifen was one of the first actual hormonal manipulations that was introduced into the treatment of breast cancer. And tamoxifen, which is a pill, how wonderful, it's not chemotherapy, was yeah. introduced and called an estrogen blocker. Mm-hmm. And people would say, well, wait, if I'm blocking estrogen, how come that's working and you're allowing me to take estrogen? Well, tamoxifen is not an estrogen blocker. It works in at least 10 different ways. Mm-hmm. And we now know that it works largely independent of its effect taking up the place on an estrogen receptor and diminishing estrogen's ability to attach to the receptor. Let me mention first that before we had tamoxifen, the first hormonal treatment for breast cancer was estrogen, high-dose estrogen, which was associated mm-hmm. with a 44% decrease in the measurable breast cancer.
Mm.
Tamoxifen, which works in many different ways, we were told, cannot be given to premenopausal women, because when tamoxifen is given to premenopausal women, the level of circulating estrogen can go up 4 or 5-fold. And so when mm-hmm. tamoxifen first came out, and I was in practice at that time, we were told mm-hmm. we can only treat postmenopausal women with tamoxifen. It turns out tamoxifen, even though it dramatically increases the risk of circulating estrogen, yet it often controls breast cancer when it's measured. Tamoxifen is more effective when administered to premenopausal women than to postmenopausal women, and now we give it only to premenopausal women. Vernon Craig Jordan, who is the doctor responsible for introducing tamoxifen, has given talks around the world saying, you know, what happens is after a while, if measurable breast cancer has responded to tamoxifen, at some point it stops. And when it stops, do you know what works and causes the breast cancer to further shrink? Low-dose estrogen. It's the environment we have to focus on, and we haven't been doing that enough.
So that's so interesting, because and it probably has everything to do with the receptor status in the breast and how the estrogens and the tamoxifen sort of respond, right? Like in terms of if you saturate the receptors with tamoxifen.
I'd love to have a glass like that. And the problem is... Yeah. Simple answers, at least so far, don't seem to work. You know, the estrogen receptor alone, without estrogen, the estrogen receptor alone is capable of increasing the risk of breast cancer growth. And now treatments have evolved from tamoxifen, which used to be called an estrogen blocker. They're now called a selective estrogen receptor modulator. And if you don't understand what that means, you're in good company. It's vague enough that it means I'm not sure what this does. And we now have selective estrogen receptor degraders, medicines that actually damage or change the estrogen receptor independent of estrogen. And they are being used more and more now to treat progressive breast cancer.
So you think that's going to be sort of the next wave of what people...
It already is.
Okay, yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay, amazing. And so like what kind of, in terms of looking at patients that you've treated with breast cancer, are there... Do you want to talk about some of the lifestyle modifications that women can do that, you know, if there's so much fear around estrogen, which, you know, is a prescription that we have to give people. But I always talk to patients, you know, about their risk assessment, like let's assess your risks and let's see what you're doing in your life that can decrease your risks if you're that, you know, sort of concerned about it based on family history or other things.
So let's talk about that. If I mentioned that better than 90% of newly diagnosed breast cancer patients are cured of their breast cancer. Cured. How can I say cured if I don't know what causes breast cancer? How can I guarantee it'll never come back? Well, cured has a practical definition. The definition of is if you follow these patients and they die at an acceptable old age and they die at the same rate as patients who never had breast cancer, then we retrospectively say that population was cured of their breast cancer. The leading cause of death among women is not breast cancer, it's heart disease. Heart disease kills up to 7 times as many women as breast cancer does. And estrogen decreases the risk of serious heart disease by 50%. Everybody acknowledges that now. That's not a source of contention. The contention is there are people who say, well, in order for estrogen to be safe, it should be given within 10 years of the last menstrual period. Okay. Actually, most women who take estrogen start it within 10 years of the last menstrual period. When I say that heart disease kills 7 times as many women as breast cancer, what I'm usually told is, well, old women die of heart disease, young women die of breast cancer, and I'd rather die when I'm old than when I'm young. Well, of course. But in fact, in every decade of a woman's life, starting at age 40, her risk of dying of heart disease is greater than her risk of dying of breast cancer. And the difference widens with every successive decade. And estrogen decreases the risk of heart disease. So implicit in your question is, doctor, don't just treat my cancer, treat me. I want to live as well as I can, as long as I can. And hormones help you do that. In addition, bone morbidity and mortality is real. Osteoporotic hip fracture is associated with almost as many deaths in the United States every year as breast cancer. Associated with means that about 20% of women who fracture their hip will die within a year of the hip fracture, and it's not due to some disease that caused the hip fracture. It's just once you get immobilized, it's hard. There are complications that develop. Right. And so I think it is reasonable, and this is a long way around to answer your question, to do things that help your heart. Obviously, exercise is good. Breathing is good. Exercise that helps keep your bones as flexible and resistant to fracture as possible is good. But none of them replace the benefits of estrogen. Sleeping well is good. Estrogen helps that. Getting around the symptoms of menopause is good. It makes you more productive. It gives you a better feeling about the life you are living. And there's nothing that touches estrogen for the symptoms of menopause.
Absolutely. What about when people talk about like alcohol and, you know, obviously cigarette smoking, we know about, but alcohol as, you know, a risk that is just as much as hormones for some people?
Well, first, what we've just done is said that the risk of hormones, while it's not zero, because I wish I knew a lifestyle or something that we could take that could reduce our risk of serious disease to zero, but the risk of estrogen alone has not been confirmed. And estrogen and progesterone, if it exists at all, the Women's Health Initiative didn't show that it's increased. And the risk of death, they don't even claim the risk of death from breast cancer is increased with hormones. Alcohol has been associated with a variety of problems, never mind drunk driving and death from automobile accidents and liver disease. There is no clearly safe alcohol dose that you can take on a daily basis. I am not a drinker. I usually sip from my wife's wine glass. That's the extent of the alcohol I take in. But I'm also not a purist, and there are things. I live in a city. When I first moved to Los Angeles, smog was a real problem. I drive in my car, recognizing that if I walked everywhere, I would be at less risk of automobile accidents. But there are trade-offs in life that you you assume. I think the limit of two drinks a day is reasonable. I don't have data to support how much or how little the risk is, but you try to do things in moderation and have the most meaningful life you can structure for yourself.
Absolutely. I think that's what's really important. I want to talk also about the FDA removing the boxed warning off of estrogen last month, which was a huge win. I think that some people think that it just came out of nowhere, but this is decades in the making of trying to get it off because it shouldn't have been there in the first place. How do you think this is going to impact, or do you think it's going to impact access? Do you think that this is going to swing? A lot of people are like, oh, it's going to swing the pendulum the other way and, you know, everyone's going to get it and we're going to see all this increases in other things. What is your thoughts on that?
When I was in high school, the two careers that I was considering was law and medicine.
I thought you were going to say law.
And law, I ruled out very early because our legal system is based on conflict. You have a lawyer, you have a prosecutor, and there is a conflict that's inherent in the system, and then somebody wins the conflict. And I naively thought that in medicine, we're all on the same side.
I know.
We want the same thing. It's going to be so much more exciting to hold hands with everybody and work toward that. And I found, to my consternation, that there are conflicts within medicine as well. And the people who are against hormones are often against hormones not based on data, which is why I keep referring to data. I started by saying I don't claim I have the right answer and I'm open to change, but I'm critically open to change. Not because somebody says something that I think is well phrased. And I've spoken to academicians who disagreed with me. And one last year, I was speaking to one, and that particular doctor thought that estrogens were harmful and kept referring to the Women's Health Initiative. And I presented what I thought were reasonable arguments against what that doctor was saying. And finally, I had to say to that doctor, I feel that we're talking at each other instead of with. It was like we were sounding off a statement without
hearing
them. And that's so frustrating. And as you are well aware, that still exists. I think taking the black box warning off of all estrogen-containing products makes sense based on the data we have today. But it's still going to be a long road. I started by telling you the story of my first experience with the FDA to show you that in 1997, which is now 28 years ago, I thought that battle was open. And then in 2002, we were right back at the beginning.
That's insane, actually. And I think so much is amplified now because there's so much on social media and people are talking. And, you know, patients get confused because different clinicians are kind of look like they're almost bickering online, where it's like, you know, everyone has sort of what they believe to be true based on their interpretation of the data. And so I think it's very, I'm glad that you said that because I feel like people listening sometimes, you know, even come to me very confused, like, well, is that true? You know, I heard so-and-so say this, but I heard so-and-so say this. And I was like, let's focus on your symptoms and let's talk about what we know and what we don't know and then how we can help you. Because I think at the end of the day, we all just want to do that, right? We want to be the best clinicians that we can.
Of the most help to help patients live long and healthy lives to the best of our ability.
To the best of our ability, yeah. I mean, you know, because, you know, I don't practice obstetrics anymore, but, you know, I do think that OBGYNs get vilified a lot because we don't have control over every pregnancy outcome, but we are held accountable for every pregnancy outcome. And some things you just can't control, right? Things happen, they go wrong. We don't understand all the science and we can only do so much. And so I feel like, you know, again, very few of us go into this profession because we are villains. You know, for most of us really want to help people. So I think, you know,
which brings up the next step, as best I can tell. An easy answer, which I don't agree with, is many people show how they feel by saying, we need more studies done for women. Well, that's not the answer. We need more data.
But right.
the study, the Women's Health Initiative, was a $1 billion study. We are never going to do a study like that again. And that set us back more than 25 years.
Yes.
What we need is more data. And one of the ways I have suggested we move forward is say to women, first, you unfortunately have an obligation to be as informed as you can be. And as a physician, I will do everything I can to help inform you in as unbiased a way as I can. And your physician has a responsibility if she or he are going to manage this aspect of your life to also be as informed as possible. And one way to do that is to write up an informed consent form, where a woman can go into a doctor and say, look, doctor, this is an informed consent form that reviews as best I know the benefits and the risks of taking hormones. This is for women right now who don't have a history of breast cancer. And mm-hmm. I recognize that we live in a litigious society, and I don't want to sue you, and I don't want you to be so afraid of a suit that you won't even discuss this with me. And so right. what I'm willing to do is sign an informed consent form that says, I recognize you are not giving me guarantees, but we agree on the data to this point, and I will sign this form so that I can remove most of that anxiety, so that shouldn't enter into our discussion here. And mm-hmm. Carol Tavris and I, have an Instagram yes. site that we put up 2 years ago on under Instagram at Estrogen Matters. And yeah. we have a model informed consent form that can be manipulated out, yeah. to fit an individual woman's need. But the other part of that, and this is harder, and I'm trying to make this happen, is we collect so much data now. I would love to have the ability to say to a doctor, a lot of your medical record is electronic now, and what mm-hmm. we'd like is to get some of that data that we can use so that we keep track of all these patients who have signed the informed consent form, and we learn mm-hmm. as time goes on what happens, and if we're wrong, let's learn that as soon as we can so that we can alter what we're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a wonderful informed consent form for both clinicians and patients. Patient can print it out and bring it to the office. The clinicians can tailor it to their own office. But I do think that's true. And I think especially because OBGYNs have traditionally been the ones that were thought to be the ones that should be prescribing hormones. And we are the most likely to get sued for obstetrics related things, right? Because we have such a high malpractice. I do think the fear of litigation prevents and precludes a lot of them from really looking at this and trying to.
Let's recognize that and work with it within the system.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I think that's great what you've done. I love your book. I think it's made such a difference in not only the lives of probably the patients reading it, but truly in clinicians. Like I do think that there are some clinicians that, you know, there's so much I learned in it too, even though I had an initial interpretation of the WHI, like getting into the nitty gritty, like really understanding from an oncologist's perspective. I feel like that's really important too, that you're someone that's, you put people into menopause year after year for so long. And then, you know, you realize you yourself didn't even realize what was happening for those patients. So I think that you're doing so much great work. And I really appreciate that as another doctor, that I've been able to really use this. I have patients coming in with this book every day, like, well, I've read Estrogen Matters. And I'm like, yes, like, high five, let's talk about it. Because I think that it really does empower people to, you know, take the best care of their health.
What we're really grateful for is the problem is not limited to the United States. The book mm-hmm. has now been translated into German and Chinese and Spanish, and a Amazing. Polish edition is on the way. And I get letters from all over the world, and they sound the same way. I went into my doctor, and my doctor said to me, we're not even going to talk about that. And if you insist on talking about that, you will have to find another doctor. That's from Bangladesh. not just from Illinois.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I have to tell you a story, though. Like, there was a patient recently. This is just to talk about what removal of the boxed warning meant for this clinician. I had a patient who had a history of DCIS and was suffering horribly with all the worst because she was going through menopause herself after her treatment. And she went to her surgeon, she went to her, you know, clinicians. Nobody wanted to give her any estrogen. So we spoke about it and we did treat her, you know, and she was doing much better on her symptoms. And then she went back to her oncologist, and this was like 2 weeks after the boxed warning came off. And they were like, "I'm so glad you're on estrogen." And the months before, they were like, "Hard stop. We will not give this to you." And she goes, "Well, what's changed?" And she goes, "Well, now we know it's safer than it ever was," or something like that. Like, I don't think she had read the data. Most people don't have time maybe to get deep into it. But that person, that oncologist, was finally like, "I'm so glad you're on estrogen and your life is better." Isn't that amazing?
I mean, good enough. We'll accept that.
We'll accept it. You know, the fact that like the barrier was big enough for a lot of clinicians that they don't even go there. So one small step at a time.
Exactly right.
Okay. So I always end my podcast with my husband jokes that like my listeners are vigilantes. So what's your hot take or your vigilante verdict that you want listeners to remember or to take with them?
That physicians and patients are in partnership. And it's important to recognize that. The hierarchy when a patient goes into a physician is very unbalanced in favor of the physician. And that, to some degree, has to change.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Weiner is the former president of the American Society of Clinical Oncology, the largest body of oncologists in the world.
That's good.
Eric was the head of breast cancer studies and treatment at Harvard, and he is now the head of oncology at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And he was born with hemophilia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when he was a young man, he got a transfusion of factor VIII as treatment to prevent bleeding and hemophilia, and he got AIDS. And in spite of that, he went on to be a leader in medicine and in oncology, but he understands what it's like to be on the patient's side of the desk with a doctor who isn't empathetic enough or doesn't understand or isn't well informed enough.
Sure.
And his presidential address at the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting in 2023 was entitled "Partnering with Patients, the Cornerstone of Clinical Care and Research."
Wonderful.
It is online and it should be read by every patient and every physician.
Oh, amazing. I'm going to go read it myself. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Blooming. This has been great. I can't wait for it to go live. I'll let you know. I'll tag Estrogen Matters when it is. Thanks for listening, everyone. This is Dr. Samina Rahn, Gyno Girl. Thanks for listening to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Samina Rahn. Remember, I'm here to educate so you could advocate for yourself. Please join me next week.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.